The century which comes to an end tonight must rank as one of the most momentous in the history of the world. The transformation of the world during the last 100 years is nothing short of remarkable. In 1900, the final year of the 19th century, the world was in the very early days of the communications and information age. Telephones were what we would consider very antique devices, largely mechanical. There were no private lines. You didn't have the luxury even of dialing. You got an operator and you asked her to connect you to a certain number. Radios, televisions, fax machines, photocopiers, cell phones, computers were all still years away. Hard to imagine a world like that, isn't it? There had never been, in 1900, a self-powered airplane flight. Now people don't even think twice about going down to the airport. Some at the last minute buy a ticket, get on a plane, they never give a second thought to it. 100 years ago, there had never even been a flight by any kind of self-powered aircraft. Automobiles, or horseless carriages, as they were called in those days, were a novelty. Only the wealthy could afford them, and they were viewed as the sure sign that the end of the world was just around the corner. Professional sports was in its infancy. There had never been a World Series game in 1900. Basketball had been invented only 9 years before and was still being played in what we would consider the crudest of fashions. And that had to do not only with what the players wore, but the way they played the game. The United States in 1900 still had a largely rural character, whose only experience on the international stage had been a brief war with Spain just 2 years earlier. Still, the growing use of electricity was a phenomenon that was affecting everybody. And on January 1st, 1901, at the stroke of midnight in Times Square in New York, there was a dazzling electric sign with letters spelled out on it which welcomed the 20th century. So it was obvious that they knew the truth, that the century does not begin in the year ending with zero. That signaled that the new century was going to be far different than the old one. In 1900, the art of cinema was still in its silent, black and white, and rather jerky days. But it was evident already that this new technology was exerting a grip on the attention of the public. The 20th century, as Theodore Roosevelt had foreseen in 1899, would be the time for the United States to emerge as a dominant power in the world. He was elected vice president in 1900 and became president less than a year later when William McKinley was assassinated. It was the youthful and energetic style of Theodore Roosevelt which marked the attitude of the United States as a rising world power. And it was a predictor of the way in which this nation would respond to the challenge of two global wars fought in the first half of this century. Now, at the end of the century, the world is riding the wave of instant communications. And the power of video images has brought even the remotest parts of the world into the view of most people. The exploration of space has become fairly routine. It's still dangerous, still fraught with peril, but it goes on all the time. Space shuttles are now routinely being launched, carrying up equipment to continue the construction of the International Space Station, which now has a permanent crew on it. It's a very different world then than the one that existed 100 years ago. And nowhere is that more true than in the field of religion. When the 20th century began, there was still going on a vigorous, and I mean vigorous, defense of the cardinal doctrines of Christianity against the rising influence of German rationalism, or what was called in the United States modernism. The deadening effects of that modernism, or liberalism as it's also called in theology, were already appearing as Protestant denominations began to waver in their positions on the Bible and the doctrines which were taught in it. In fact, in the 1920s, in Northern Ireland, there was a notable trial in which a professor at the Irish Presbyterian College was charged with believing things that were contrary to Scripture. And though it was evident he did believe those things, yet he was still exonerated of the charges and allowed to remain in his position. Before the end of the century, the end which comes tonight, there would be a dismaying capitulation to the forces of satanic perversion. Not only within mainline Protestantism, that capitulation, as I said, was already underway in the early years of the century, but in the last half of the century, that capitulation has also been manifested in so-called evangelical circles. In fact, the 20th century can be divided almost exactly into two halves. The first half was a time of powerful preaching and of serious efforts, both scholarly and popular, to reassert the historic foundations of the Christian faith. In fact, in 1909, a series of essays was published in several volumes under the title The Fundamentals. And that gave rise to the use of the term fundamentalist to describe one who subscribed to those truths that were laid out in those volumes. There was an awareness in that time that a battle to preserve the legacy of biblical truth was raging, and that it was not a time for negotiations with the enemies of the gospel. In 1925, there was a famous trial that took place in Tennessee, in the town of Dayton, Tennessee. That trial pitted the state of Tennessee against a biology teacher named John T. Skokes, who had the gall to teach in his classroom that man had evolved from apes, in contradiction to the law of Tennessee, which prohibited any such teaching. Skokes was arrested, he was charged with the crime, and two of the most prominent personalities of that period came to this little town in Tennessee to contest this battle. Clarence Darrow, famous criminal defense attorney from Maryland, came to defend Skokes. Darrow was a noted skeptic and atheist. The prosecuting attorney was William Jennings Bryan, who three times had been defeated in bids to be president of the United States, and who had served just the previous decade in the Wilson administration. And that trial placed in the focus of the popular mind the whole issue of creation versus evolution. And while the result of the trial was a conviction of the teacher, nevertheless, in the popular mind, Darrow had swayed the day and had painted Bryan and those who supported him as relics of a bygone era. And many were convinced that it was time to abandon the old ways. But there were others who saw just as clearly that they had to continue to wage this fight even to the end. That was in 1925. By the time 25 more years had passed, 1950, by that time a whole different approach was being adopted by the same evangelicals who had stood behind Bryan in that trial in Tennessee. Because they were afraid, as they saw the trend of the century developing, they were afraid they were going to lose their influence and their voice in the popular sphere. And so they began to adopt a different approach. They began to enter into dialogue with modernists. They began to include them in their campaigns of mass evangelism. And in 1948, there began in the city of Amsterdam a new movement called the World Council of Churches, which was a combination of several previously existing movements, and that signaled a move toward more ecumenical activity, toward the creation of cooperation among churches. And so together with the new approach in evangelicalism, there was signified a powerful shift from confrontation of error to accommodation with it. And that paved the way for the acceleration of the ecumenical express. So this century has witnessed an alarming departure from the heritage of the Protestant Reformation and the growth of a willingness in many quarters to wish that the Reformation had never taken place at all. And that's true even in many evangelical circles. What is at stake here is nothing less than the very heart of the gospel message. How are people saved? The passage of Scripture that we have read this evening speaks of apostasy. The horrible prospect of apostasy. Of a repudiation, a willful forsaking of that which has been confessed to be true. This passage speaks of a time when there was a real battle going on. Of the former days of which we read in verse 32. In which after ye were illuminated, ye endured a great fight of afflictions. There was a battle that went on. And there was now a danger that they would cast away that for which there was formerly a contending. It is the drawing back of which Hebrews speaks here, which represents the spirit of this century that is now coming to its end. And if there is one phrase we can use to describe our century this evening, it must be this one. The 20th century. From battle stations to white flags. That, I believe, sums up the religious history of this century. The message of Hebrews chapter 10, the portion that we have read, is very clear. Those who are truly Christ's people will never abandon their responsibility earnestly to contend for the faith. They may have to be reminded of the need to contend for the faith, but they're not going to abandon it. They're not going to repudiate it. They will not, as we read in verse 39, draw back unto perdition. And let us realize the significance of that remark. If you draw back, Hebrews is saying here, if you abandon Christ, that is a sign that you never belong to Him at all. And it means you are still bound for perdition. Those who draw back unto perdition. They draw back to that place to which the son of perdition, Judas Iscariot, went when he killed himself. That's where they draw back. The message is that a solemn charge has been given to the people of God. And what does that charge relate? We learn in this passage, we have a great high priest over the house of God. Jesus Christ, the great high priest. What has that great high priest done? He has come into this world We've just passed through the Christmas season again. We have remembered the reality of the incarnation, that Jesus Christ came into this world, that He came here to save His people from their sins. And how did He do that? He lived in their place, the life of perfect obedience they did not have the ability to live. He died in their place, the death they could never die in its fullness. And He made an end of all the wrath that was laid against them. So He lived. He died on the cross. He laid down His life, as He said. They took Him down from the cross after He had consciously dismissed His spirit. And then, on the third day, He rose from the dead. And then, 40 days afterward, He ascended up into heaven. And that, by the way, is a part of the gospel message that often gets left out. We speak about the crucifixion and the resurrection, but the ascension was a very important part of this story because He ascended back up, as He said, where He had been before, back into heaven. And what is He doing there now? He is interceding now for His people. He is the first fruits of them that slept. He is the pledge that those whom He has redeemed will also in their flesh come to that place. They will come to see God. And because we have such a high priest, we read here, what are we to do then? Let us draw near. Let us draw near. Let us hold fast, as we read in verse 23, the profession of our faith without wavering. Now that expression is very important, I believe, in this whole passage, without wavering. Because what we read here as we go on is a case of people who are wavering. And we're going to see this is the whole problem that leads to the destructive compromise that has cursed this century. Let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering. That is, we're not called upon here to sit in a situation where we're saying, well, you know, I hope this is true. I mean, I don't know, but I mean, it's all we've got, so I hope this is true. The whole argument is Jesus Christ is in heaven. We have a great high priest over the house of God. So let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering. Why? Because we read in verse 23, He is faithful that promised. What's that promise? That He is going to come again. I believe that's what that refers to. He is going to come again. He is faithful. Let us hold fast. Let us, as we read in verse 24, let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works. Notice the order in which that's put. There are so many Christians today who lose sight of the order of this verse. And they, in fact, sometimes they just leave out the first part altogether. Let us provoke one another unto good works. But it's unto love and good works. And to love of what? Principally to love of the great high priest. Because if you love the great high priest, you won't have to be urged very hard onto doing good works. And so let us, he says, not forsake the assembling of ourselves together. As the manner of some is. Even in the first century, there were people who said, you know, I don't need to go to church. I have my own church. Right in my house. You'd be surprised how many people there are who have that attitude. And what we learn here is this is not a Christian attitude. It's not a biblical attitude. I don't care if they watch TV and consider that their church. What is in view here is that because we have a high priest in heaven, let us not forsake the assembling of ourselves together with others as the manner of some is. And especially because we see that the day of Christ's appearing is approaching. And as I said this morning, now over 6,000 years of human history has passed away. And the day that is fixed for the appearing of Christ is nearer than it has ever been before. It is approaching nearer, so there's even a greater incentive than ever before to be engaged in these things. So then the message is, this is not the time to surrender. This is not the time to cave in and to give up. This is the time to redouble our efforts for the cause of the kingdom of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, I want us this evening to consider very briefly, and I do intend to be brief. It's always a risk for a preacher to say that, but anyway, that's my intention. Let us consider four basic aspects of our theme, from battle stations to white flags. First of all, let us consider the warfare for the gospel. In the 19th century, there was tremendous conflict in the Christian world over the message of the gospel. The rationalism that emerged from Germany in the wake of the Reformation was having its effect in various parts of the world, especially in the United Kingdom. In England and in Scotland and in Ireland as well, there was a tremendous battle going on. There were times of great revival blessing. But many men risked everything they had worked to achieve, their positions in pastorates, their positions in presbyteries and in Baptist unions and all of that. They risked everything they had worked to achieve to stand for the truth of the gospel. You see, rationalism had robbed the Reformation of much of its driving force. It was the counterattack of the devil against the thrust of the Protestant reformers. And the preachers of the gospel had been laboring to resist this rationalism. In Scotland, in the 1840s, a man named Thomas Chalmers, who was part of the Church of Scotland, led 400 younger ministers, some of whom he had trained personally, to take a forthright stand against the Church of Scotland and disrupted the church. They seceded from it. They withdrew from it. There was a very public meeting. I've read accounts of it. You'd almost wish you could be there just to see it, where these 400 men meeting in a huge building where there was a general assembly being held, these 400 men got up at a certain point and they all marched out the center aisle, out through the doors, outside, never to come back into that place again. Why did they do that? Because there was pressure to water down the doctrines of the gospel to suit the spirit of those who had criticized the Reformation. And rather than accede to that, they disrupted the church. In other words, they gave up everything that they had spent their lives building in order to take their stand for the truth. Now, today, people would look at that and say, boy, those were foolish people, weren't they? To be so overwrought over technicalities. But to them, it was not a technicality. It was that kind of a spirit that was personified throughout the second half of the 19th century, was personified in Baptist circles by Charles Spurgeon, who took a stand against the Baptist Union, who said when he was entreated, look, these are all Baptists. We all believe in baptism by immersion. And when he heard that, he said, I'd rather take my stand with someone with whom I disagree on baptism and agree on everything else than I would take my stand with someone with whom I agree on baptism and disagree on everything else. And so Spurgeon stood against the Baptist Union. He was outvoted 2,000-7, his own brother voting in the majority. But Spurgeon didn't care because he said, what have I to do to be concerned about how many people are on my side? I am here to stand for the truth. Here was the spirit of warfare for the gospel. And yes, it meant that he had to endure tremendous criticism in the press from all sides. There were some who thought he didn't go far enough, and others thought he went too far. His great contemporary, the Scottish Presbyterian preacher Andrew Bonar, was another one who took his stand. Bonar was one of those young students of Thomas Chalmers who joined with his professor in the disruption of 1843. And at the end of his ministry, there came a time again where Bonar had to take a stand. And again, depart as an old man from that which he had spent his life trying to accomplish. Spurgeon and Bonar died in the same year, in 1892. Now, they left their successors a lot of reason to continue this good fight. And so, as the first half of this century came about, there were already in place men who had learned the lessons of those who had gone before them, and they were standing for the truth. There were a number of conferences that were held in the later part of the 19th century, conferences which were designed to emphasize the fundamental doctrines of Christianity and to take a stand for those doctrines. It was a time for preaching the truth wherever it was possible, and of contending for the truth, pointing out the errors of those who were against the truth. You see, it was not a time such as we have now where they said, well, let's just be positive. You know, let's not get into all this negative business of pointing out how these people have departed from the truth. Now, in the first half of this century, there were moves of God in various places around the world. And there was a resolve among evangelicals that they were not going to be moved away from those historic foundations. They preached, they wrote, they even debated. Yes, they would debate. They would take on those who had departed from the faith. And that was an effort that brought together people of various denominational backgrounds. They had a common cause. They knew they were in a fight for the gospel. They knew that they were in a fight to defend the historic doctrines of Christianity. Doctrines like the inspiration of the Bible. Doctrines like the deity and virgin birth of Jesus Christ. Doctrines like the necessity of Christ's atonement on the cross for the redemption of sinners. Doctrines like the reality of the bodily resurrection of Christ from the grave. Doctrines like the historic reality of the creation of man by the direct act of God. Doctrines like the insistence on the necessity of the new birth for salvation and on the fact that the new birth was something carried out solely by the Holy Spirit. Rejecting any idea that a man could merit his salvation by his own works. And of course, these men also argued that if you have been born again, it's going to be evident by the way in which you live. You're not going to live like those around you. Now, in the first half of this century, there was a tremendous movement that took place that resulted in 1919 in an amendment to the U.S. Constitution which made it illegal to sell intoxicating beverages in this country. Now, that period lasted for 14 years. Another amendment to the Constitution in 1933, repealed that amendment. But I want to tell you that was an indication of the way in which the power of God's Word affected this country in that period. Now today, you know, the common thing is they talk about that as, my, that was such a bad time. People couldn't drink. Of course, they did drink anyway. They drank illegally all over the place. It was such a bad time. I mean, it led to so much crime and all of that. But the fact of the matter is, deaths from cirrhosis of the liver plunged during that period. In many ways, it was one of the best times. But they argued that those who were born again should not live as those about them. And they wouldn't yield. They were battling for the truth. But while this was going on, the devil was marshaling his forces behind the scenes. There was an effort underway, in the words of Hebrews 10, to tread underfoot the Son of God. What you see going on today in the ecumenical movement is exactly that. It is a treading underfoot of the Son of God. It is a despising of the blood of the covenant as an unholy thing. A new spirit began to emerge near the middle of this century, and it was the spirit of compromise. That brings me to the second thing I want to point out, the wavering of the faithful. We've already noted how we are called upon in verse 23 to hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering. But near the middle of this century, following the Second World War, there was an idea that surfaced that the way to win the argument with the infidels was to find common ground with them on which they could agree. Those who urged this kind of approach were embarrassed. Because you see, if you look at verses 32 and 33, they had endured a great fight of afflictions, but they were embarrassed because they had become a gazing stock by reproaches and afflictions. And they were embarrassed to become companions of those that were so used. They didn't like to be associated with these, what they called, fighting fundamentalists. They wanted greater acceptance from the world at large. I've already noted one of the key events of this century in religious history. In 1948, the formation of the World Council of Churches. And that council met with the express purpose, and this was said by those who attended the council, who organized the council. The express purpose was to reverse the trend that had begun at the Reformation. That's what they wanted to do. There was a spirit of union and cooperation. Let's all come together. And in the World Council of Churches, they had a statement of faith, but they said, if you don't believe this, that's all right. You can still be part of the council as long as you profess belief in some God. Well, just about anybody could do that. So now, they were casting doubt on the old way of confrontation. No, that's not the way. This day is too sophisticated now. We can't confront these people. We'll just look like idiots and ignoramuses. Now, there were some people who were genuinely confused. They felt sincerely that a new approach would probably be useful. And there was a debate over this new method, which was called very ominously the new evangelicalism, as opposed to the old evangelicalism that was manifested in what they called the fighting fundamentalists. Now, at the same time as this new approach developed and the faithful were now wavering, how should we do this? How should we approach these people? Questions also began to be raised about the way in which evangelism was being carried out. And in fact, the whole rationale for missionary activity. And there were people who were anxious to define Christianity more in terms of its cultural context than as a body of doctrine. And so they said, how dare people go in to another society and impose their culture upon them? There were people wavering in this time. They were afraid of ending up on the losing side of the debate. So the appeal of the new evangelicalism was very, very strong. And joined to that was the third thing, the weakness of the fearful. There was a fear developing that the century was passing the fundamentalists by, that they were going to be relegated to irrelevance. The needs of the nuclear age, the space age, were so much greater than anything that had been known before. This was the lie the devil foisted upon the world in this century. That somehow people in the 20th century have different needs than the people who have lived before. But you see, the reality is the needs have not changed at all. Because in every age, people are sinners. They are born in sin. They live in sin, and there's only one way they can escape it, and that is through the work of Jesus Christ. There's no difference whether people live in the space age or in the stone age. They are still sinners in need of the message of the gospel. But you see, the attitude in the middle of this century, and now I'm speaking of a time when some people who are here tonight can remember, this goes back to the days of their youth. We won't say how far into their youth it goes back, but into the days of their youth, they can remember when the whole idea of an atomic age and technology and the space age, Sputnik and all of that, you know, when all of this made people believe that there really was a difference, that somehow people had been changed, and that there needed to be a new approach to delivering the message of the gospel. And the key event here was the defection from the fundamentalist camp to the new evangelical camp of a young evangelist who had been very, very successful. His name was Billy Graham. And that defection came just before a citywide campaign he was to conduct in New York in 1957, when he made it be known that for the first time he would not be under the sponsorship of the fundamentalists in New York City. He would instead seek the sponsorship of the Ministerial Association, the Ecumenical Association, so that they could give him a wider sphere in which to preach, and also significantly, so that they could get more favorable coverage in the press and in the media. Many could not resist the temptation. They were afraid. They were afraid. They were going to be left on the sidelines. They saw the success of Graham. They saw the success of others who were working with him. And they said, we can't be left back. We've got to go in the same direction. They lacked patience. Notice what we read in Hebrews 10 and verse 36. Ye have need of patience. Here is what the people of God need. They need patience to stay the course. Patience that after you have done the will of God, you might receive the promise. Patience to say, this is the Bible. And it doesn't matter what age we live in. The Bible's message is the same. Patience then to stay the line, to stay true to the gospel message, not to sell the gospel out for ecumenical cooperation and favor. They lacked that patience, and so they ended up aligning themselves with the enemies of the truth. And then they surrendered. That's the last thing, the wickedness of the surrender, the white flag. What a change this is. The century begins with people at their battle stations. They are identifying everything that is departing from the faith and they're attacking it. Now, these same people, they have surrendered. They put the white flag up. They're saying there's not much difference between us and them. Now they sign agreements like evangelicals and Catholics together, which say that really the differences between us are very small. There's the whole spirit of the age. Well, I beg to differ. The differences between what this book says and what Romanism says are as wide as the Grand Canyon and certainly deeper. They're not insignificant differences. But evangelicals have surrendered. They put up the white flag just so that they can be thought of favorably by the press and the media and the politicians, so they can get invitations to prayer breakfasts and White House luncheons and all the rest of it. What is the scene that we see as the century ends? What has happened in evangelicalism? A cultivation of the popular culture. Turning so-called Bible-believing churches into citadels of entertainment. That's what has happened in evangelicalism. They've bought into the idea that we have to abandon anything that smacks of authority. We can't have the firm and authoritative preaching of the Word because people are put off by it. After all, this is the end of the 20th century. And people are more modern now. You know, they don't like being told what to do. Well, no sinner has ever liked being told what to do. And so the white flags go up. Do we stand against the popular culture? Do we stand against drift, doctrinal drift and departure? No, we don't stand against that. Instead, we open our doors and say, come on in. Make us relevant to society.
Well, in the midst of this wicked surrender, strikingly, nearly 50 years ago, our own denomination came into existence. And it came to existence in the second half of this century, we believe, by the call of God to fight against this very trend. To insist upon the preaching of the Scriptures as the central act of worship. To resist the effort to turn churches into entertainment centers. To resist the temptation to enter into agreements with the enemies of the gospel. Nearly 50 years ago, Ian Paisley was a young man. He was called upon to take a stand for the truth. And there were many men who stood with him against that which marked the spirit of their time. The World Council of Churches was only 3 years old, but the Irish Presbyterian Church had gone into it full bore. And the man who had been a professor of theology when he was tried for heresy had become the moderator of the Irish Presbyterian Church. And that tells you just where they were standing. So they formed a new church. And they were made a gazing stock. They suffered great afflictions. They were involved in a terrific fight and are to this very day. We're involved in it too. And while evangelicals all around us, and since I've been here for these last 15 years, I have watched them fall by the wayside, capitulate to the spirit of compromise, the popular culture, the idea that we have to somehow make the gospel relevant. The gospel is always relevant. It is always relevant. There is a need tonight for the people of God still to remain firm. That's the whole point of Hebrews 10. Let us hold fast. Let us hold fast. Let us not surrender. Let us not be tempted to run up the white flag. Let's take the white flag and tear it up into little pieces and throw it away. What's the point? The battle's not going to last forever. Notice verse 37. For yet a little while. It's just a little while. This century is coming to an end. It's just a little while. And he that shall come will come. And will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith. One of the four times in the Bible you find that expression, the just shall live by faith. How are we to live? How are we to battle? By faith. So our position is unpopular. Elijah thought he was the only one left. The Lord said, no, I have 7,000. But even so, that wasn't too many. There were 7,000 who hadn't bowed the knee to Baal. That wasn't too many. But there were some. So the position is unpopular. It's just a little while. Just a little while. And he that shall come will come. The just shall live in that little while by faith. Not with their eyes on those who are against them, but with their eyes on the one who is now in heaven. The one who has triumphed over all his enemies. The day for receiving the promise is at hand. So let this new century that will dawn in just a few hours be marked by our willingness to stand in the evil day. Having done all to stand, I don't think there is a greater call that can come to us as a people of God. Do we live in an evil day? Yes. It is a day of apostasy. It is a day of surrender among evangelicals on a broad scale. It is an evil day. The old contending for the faith that marked the beginning of the century has been dropped. It is an evil day. So what do we do? Do we join those who are surrendering? No. Paul says in Ephesians, we put on the armor and we stand. And the darts come against us. And the attacks come against us. We are made a gazing stock, as we find in verse 33. We become companions of those that are attacked. And we stand. loins girt about with truth, having on the breastplate of righteousness, having on the helmet of salvation, using the shield of faith, having our shoes shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace, using the sword of the Spirit with staff. Because in a little while, the battle will be over. Those who have stood for Christ will not be ashamed that they did so when that day comes. So may God make it a happy new year, a happy new century, a happy new millennium. May the people of God be resolved more than ever before that though the day is dark, they can see that in just a little while, the light is going to shine again. And on that day, we will rejoice that we had the patience to keep on in the faith of the gospel.